Yeah. So good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. The name of this particular workshop, which I'm giving, is When Simple Pshat Is Not So Simple, Utilizing Linguistic and Literary Tools to Shed Light on the Meaning of Our Verse. Now, I remember I was once on an airplane. My wife and I were waiting to go on a trip, and they announced anybody, we're ready now to depart for, at the time it was to New York, we thought we were going to New York, and they said, we're going to New York, and the guy said, New York? I'm going to Denver. So if anybody is going to Denver instead of New York, now's the time. All right. Very often we'll hear, it could be our sons, it could be our daughters, more often sons than daughters. They'll say, I heard a beautiful pshat yesterday. And I always think about it, maybe you didn't, maybe you didn't. It might be beautiful, but we don't know whether it's pshat. What he really means is, I heard a beautiful perush, a beautiful interpretation yesterday. Interpretations come in different forms, but not all of them are pshat. They could all be wonderful, no question about that. But so we're going to talk about the difference between pshat and drash today, at least to help us. No 45-minute period is going to make us expert in that area, but hopefully it will give us entree to move on in our studies and to look at psukim in a way that might be slightly different than we looked at them before. So allow me, please. I prepared four examples, even though there were five on the packet.
There are five on the packet.
Somebody take that.
Yeah, it's fine. I can just. Okay. Thank you. Let me just. Thank you. It's very kind. Yeah. In the interest of time, we'll do that. So we're going to go pretty much in order. I will be giving out one more sheet in just a few minutes after we go to our introduction, which is if you open the first, and thank you very much for distributing it, if you look at the first page where it says, When Simple Pshat Is Not So Simple, this is an introduction. We always need to define terms, because when you hear a certain word or I hear a certain word, for example, if I hear the word hit, right, if I'm at a baseball game, so then it has one meaning. If I'm in front of a computer, or if I'm a computer designer, I have my own website, a hit means a different thing. And so when we use terminology, one of the things I want to do is to have us have the same terminology so that we're on the same page. Please feel free to interrupt with questions at any time. If I feel that we're getting too far afield, or if I feel that no matter how good it is, we may not accomplish what we need to, then with your kind permission, I'll say we'll pick it up maybe after class. But hopefully, please, if you have a question, if there's something I said you don't understand, or if there's something that I've said that you'd like to challenge, I'm with you, okay? I learned more from challenges than just about anything else, because the challenge means that the person who is listening is thinking it through very hard, and I may not have. And so, therefore, please don't say, well, he's probably right. Maybe, maybe not, like Pshat. All right, let's take a look. For our purposes today, the word pshat means as follows. It is an interpretation of a biblical text, anyone, from Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz to Shema Yisrael, an interpretation of a biblical text that conforms to the elements of context, of syntax, and of semantics. And I call them CSS. Now, everything that's in writing has to be interpreted. Everything. So you'll say, no, it doesn't. Well, let's see. Let's test the thesis. I'm driving along at about 35 miles an hour, the speed limit, and I see, because my eyes are pretty good, I see about 200 feet up the road, there is an octagonal sign which has the letters STOP on it. Okay? Does that need interpretation?
No.
Yeah. because if I immediately put my foot on the brakes, then I'm not. That's not what that sign means. It means when all of this is all the perush of that. When you get toward the intersection, you begin the process of ceasing to drive forward. That's what it means. It doesn't mean slam your foot on the brake now, right? On the other hand, if I'm an ambulance driver, that stop sign has a different value, a different meaning for me, because different rules apply. And so therefore, when we talk about pshat in a pasuk, what we find is that our interpretation has to conform to three areas. Number one, the context. If I want my interpretation to be pshat, which we're going to say, let us just simply say right now, is the simple forward interpretation, then it has to be understood in the context of what's going on. So, for example, if we're talking about Avraham Avinu, and we're saying that Avraham Avinu went from Hebron to, shall we say, to Be'er Sheva, and I say what he did is he took a car, which I wouldn't, I violated it. Now, that's not only not drash, that's a violation of the understanding of pshat, because it's completely out of context. Now, that's an absurd example, but the context is very important. But I'll give you another one. Avraham Avinu, or better yet, Sarah Imenu, says, Garesh et ha'ama hazot. You need to throw this person out. This when she's talking about Yishmael, but about Hagar as well. Throw him out there, all right? So when I have a situation where Sarah Imenu is considered to be the Amud HaChesed, along with Avraham Avinu, and she says, Garesh et ha'ama hazot, and I simply say, she was jealous, right? As Ibn Ezra says. So, is that pshat? Is it in conformity with the person that we know? Or the conformity of the person that we at least have come to know through Chazal? That is where context comes in.
Yes. With that example, there's a lot of contracts for surrogacy in Babylonia at the time. But then, with later commentaries, they've been lost, and now these things have been found again. Mm-hmm. So, how do you deal with that when sometimes the historical context gets lost, and these things, if you knew what was actually going on at the time, it would make a lot more sense.
At least it would alter or modify how we look at things. That's correct. So, right, if nowadays if we want to look at something in terms of pshat. Many, many biblical commentators will say, I'm talking about people who are faithful to the text and faithful to the Torah and the Shemayim, they will say also, that's right, we have to look at the historical perspective of what was going on at that time. I wouldn't deny that at all. That's part of context. Then there's syntax. I'm going to define syntax for you. Syntax is the relationship of words to each other in a sentence. Syntax is the relationship of words to each other in a sentence. Now, I'm going to give you an example so you see what I mean. If I say, yesterday, Bob will go to the store, what's the problem? Wrong tense. Maybe it's the right tense. Maybe it's the right tense. Then if that's the case,
yesterday has to be changed.
Something has to be changed. Because yesterday implies that the act has taken place, and will go implies that the act has not taken place. So here's what I have. A lack of agreement between, in this case, the verb and the adverb. Okay. So learning to define and learning to zero in. Very often people will say tense. Usually they don't say adverb. All right? But the truth is, it could be. Yesterday needs to be changed. Okay. Bill and Bob goes to the store. Well, then we have a problem because we have a compound subject, two people, and in English, what we say, they go to the store. So when that appears to occur in a pasuk, I don't ask students what's wrong with the pasuk. The pasuk is perfect the way it's written. The question is, what did I expect that I didn't get, or what didn't I expect that I did get? Oh, that's a valid question. What's wrong with the pasuk is never valid. Nothing wrong with it. Okay, and the only thing that's wrong is perhaps we ourselves do not understand maybe the background. There are a lot of things that we may not understand concerning the pasuk. And finally, semantics. CSS, semantics. Semantics are the fact that words have multiple usages. As I mentioned, the word hit. You could use the same idea of hand. They're in English. Give me a hand means one thing, all right? A handout is another thing. A hand, of course, is an appendage. We must have 6, 7, 8, 9 meanings of hand, at least if you look in the dictionary. Okay? So the context will determine which of those semantic choices I use in understanding the pasuk. Okay? So those are the three areas that I want to look into. Context, syntax, and semantics. Now, let's move now to drash. That's pshat. If I interpret the pasuk and it doesn't violate any of those things, we're going to see the examples in just a moment or two, then we're in good shape. And drash is an interpretation that deviates from pshat. That's the first element. Often the drash will either import an idea or export the reader to another time or place. So if Yaakov Avinu has a dream, and Rashi or some other great commentator says he's talking about Rome, which of course did not occur for another 1,000 years, more, 1,500 years, and if in the dream it says Rome, and nowhere in the text does it say Rome, then we have drash. So you might say, well, is drash inferior to pshat? Absolutely not. It's another way of looking and understanding the depth and the breadth of the Torah that we have. Let me give you a quick example of how pshat can be misunderstood. You know, so you've all... No, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't presume something. But so many of us went to school from the time of 4 or 5 years old, and everybody knows the story of Moshe in the basket, right? Moshe's in the basket, and Bat Paro comes by, this great, great human being. And she, of course, she's caught literally, as all great people, she's caught in conflict. Even though the Torah doesn't tell us necessarily, but you realize what a great human being she was, so her conflict must have been intense. All right, she sees a basket, and she assumes that there's somebody in there. She maybe hears something, sees something. So what do Chazal say when she opened the basket, before she opened the basket? Chazal tell us that she had what it says. How did she get to the basket? Anybody know?
Something with her hand.
She had like a bionic arm. Out of there, right? She went, the basket. Now, we're going to see, I brought this for you to see, all right, to see how Chazal get it. All right. They didn't just make this up out of the air. All right. But let me just tell you, because this is such a famous drash, that all of our children grow up thinking that in fact that's what happened. If George Orwell, you know, what did he write?
1984
and
Animal Farm.
Let's take Animal Farm. George Orwell comes to Orto. He's a little on the dead side, but George Orwell comes to Ortora because he's seen this fantastic group of people. He knows that they're intellectually sound, and he comes and he gives a talk on Animal Farm from a literary perspective. Okay, so I'm sitting in the back there, and of course I've wanted to meet George Orwell for many years. Toward the end of the lecture, I raised my hand. I said, Mr. Orwell, I must tell you, I read Animal Farm, and I learned so much from it. Probably more than any other book. So he's taken a little aback, and he says to me, "Well, Rabbi Myers, what did you learn about Animal Farm?" And I said, "I learned that pigs can actually talk." Notice how you laughed. That's what we do to Midrashim. When the Midrashim portray mountains talking, people living hundreds of years well beyond their time, Bat Paro's arm extending. If what you learn from that is that she had a bionic arm, then I think we've missed the whole point. What we need to understand is that the Midrash is telling us an important lesson. I'm sorry. That important lesson is that when people are truly great tzaddikim, tzidkaniyot, as certainly Bat Paro was, the world, they can do things far beyond anything they would have imagined or you and I can imagine. That's what the Midrash is telling us. not that she physically had a bionic arm. So when their kids are little, maybe, see, so well, they'll say, well, what if little children can't understand that? Well, then maybe little children shouldn't be taught that. That I don't know. That's for a different discussion, a different lesson. But Chazal, I'm going to ask you to turn. I'm going to just skip for a second. Ask you to turn to the back page and see what the Rambam says about Pshat and Drash. I included it last, but since we're on this, I think it's important for us to see. Now, you know, there's also a famous Medrash, which is right above this, where the Medrash, the Torah tells us that Jews on their armaments at war, they should never have to go again with Hashem's help, but they have the Torah tells us that they have to put a shovel on their armaments, al azeinecha, on your armaments, from the words kli zayin. Okay. So Rashi says that it means kli zayin, it means on your armaments, a shovel. So that when you're at war, you have to realize, even when you're in the most despicable of situations, nevertheless, you don't lose your humanity. You have to take care of hygiene, you have to take care of to make sure that the camp, v'haya machanecha kadosh, your camp has to be holy. Okay. Now, the Gemara says on that particular passage and if you look right under the line on page 5, Bar Kapara says, V'yateh tiyelecha al azeinecha, you must put a shovel on your armaments. Al tikra azeinecha, he says, don't read the word, don't limit your reading to azeinecha, ela oznecha, on your ears. Okay? Melamed she'emishma adam davar meguneh, to teach us that if somebody hears something which is vile, inappropriate speech, yitain etzba'o, which looks a little bit like shaped a little bit like a shovel, he put his etzba'o be'oznav, in his ears, so as not to hear it. That's what the Gemara says that. Okay. Now the Ramban, I probably went to school also where they told him that Bat Paro's arm was bionic. But when he was 6, he probably rejected it. Right? But let's take a look and see what the Ramban writes. It's in English. Because there are people, when they hear these midrashim, they hear them to be taken literally, people do one of two things, the Rambam says. Either they say the rabbis don't know what they're talking about, right? All right. Particularly they say the rabbis don't know what they're talking about, or the Torah doesn't know. So watch what he writes. I would like to know if these fools believe that the Tana, in this case Bar Kapar, he uses the word fools too, believes that this is the primary intent of the verse, namely that it refers to the human finger and a person's ears, not a shovel. And because the whole context again, is war. Okay, so he says, I don't believe that anyone possessed of his full intellectual faculties would believe that. Rather, it's a beautiful metaphor, used as an effective instrument to remind us that just as it is prohibited to utter gossip, so it is prohibited to listen to gossip. He uses the literary device to make his point. We rob ourselves, not if we're teachers, we rob our children, and if we're learning ourselves, we rob ourselves of the magnificence of Chazal's perspective of the world when we feel that they must be interpreted literally. We do them no injustice if we say that. On the contrary, we show that, in fact, as the more intellectually bound we are, oftentimes the more abstract we are in our thinking. And it doesn't have to be that. So that's the Rambam. And so therefore, he warns us about misusing and misunderstanding drash. Okay? That's, we jumped ahead, but that's, I think, is value for us. Now we can go back to the first page. And finally, we are now going to, we're going to define koshi. Koshi, most of us consider, you might be used to the term kasha. You know, a kasha, a question, or a koshi. In Hebrew, it's koshi. Kasha is usually used when we study Gemara. Same idea. Comes the word kasheh. Maze kasheh? Difficult. It's hard. Hard, literally. And in English, we do the same thing. It's hard to understand. We sort of concretize it. Now, for our purposes, a koshi is finding something that I did not expect to find in the pusik, or not finding something that I do expect to find in the pusik. When that happens, I have a koshi, and it must be resolved. 90 to 95% of the especially Rashi, the Ramban, and others, when they write, it's because they have a koshi in mind. Something is in the pusik that they didn't expect, or there isn't something there that they would have clearly expected to be. It might be a contradiction in terms, a contradiction in numbers. It could be a behavior like Sari Imenu's behavior that seems to be out of kilter. It could be any number of things, all right? Or it could be an anthropomorphism, where every time in the Torah that it says Vayered Hashem, Hashem went down, we have, it's an easily resolved one, but it's Hashem, since Hashem does not take up space, he goes neither up nor down. He's neither he nor she. All right, so we're limited, we're earthbound here, and so therefore we use terms. That's why, for example, the Unkelus, whenever it says Vayered, he'll usually say Itkale, Hashem revealed himself. Not taking up space, but it became God is in the room. Hashem is in the room, right? Some of us have a greater feeling of it right now. Some of us maybe have a lesser feeling, but God is in the room. If God chooses to reveal God's self, so then that would be Vayered, so to speak. All right. Now, having done that, let's get in to the issue. In just a few weeks, we're going to be reading the first example, number one. In just a few weeks, we're going to be reading the Parshio toward the end of the Devarim. And Perek Lamed, chapter 30, is considered to be Parshat Teshuva, because the Shoresh, Shuv, appears over and over again in that pasuk. So I've included it here, and we're going to, the idea is, the background of this is that through arrogance, a failure to understand, what is arrogance? A failure is to understand the relationship between me and the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's arrogance. Right? If I understood that relationship, so I wouldn't have this distorted view of my abilities and who I am. So they're then sent into we're all sent into Galut. Right? That's what the Torah tells us. You don't know how to live on the land, so you leave the land. God forbid. And then if you look on the underlying piece there in Hebrew, I'm going to read it in Hebrew and then I'll translate it. But then we do tshuva. Pasuk tells us that we do tshuva. And then it says, V'shav Hashem Elokecha et shivutcha v'richamecha. Hashem will return et shivutcha. Shivutcha, it appears, means the captives. God will return your captives v'richamecha and have compassion on you. That's all we need for right here from that piece. Rashi, right there, cites a medrash, and it's important for to know that Rashi very seldom says anything on his own. Not that he couldn't. He chose to be the conduit to bring the words of the Chachamim to us, and he would select. There would be hundreds of Midrashim in front of him. On this pasuk, there might be six or seven. He, as the editor of his own parish, selects it. And he decided to select this one out of a number. And it says as follows. Rashi says, V'shav Hashem Elokecha et shivutcha, Hashem will return your captives. Haya lo lichtov v'heshiv et shivutcha. Had it the interpretation of the pasuk bin that Hashem will return your captives, then it should have said the heshiv. It doesn't. It says v'shav Hashem. So does anybody know what's the difference between v'shav and v'heshiv? Just so I get an idea, so I'll know how to go with this. They're both in past. They're both future. I'm sorry. What?
One you're doing to someone else and one you're doing.
That's correct. Or what we're going to say, there is intransitive and transitive. Verbs that are intransitive, I sit, I stand, okay? Those are things that are intransitive, meaning to say there's no direct object. If I want to know if a sentence has a direct object, so you know, that when, then I ask the question, I build what? You say, I build a house, I build a temple, whatever it is. I sit what doesn't work. And so therefore, there's no direct object. Rashi understood this. Rashi, that's a no big deal for Rashi. The Medrash understood it. And so in Hebrew here, if I want to, let's take a sentence in English. I return to the library. That's an intransitive sentence. Why? Because I can't say I return what?
The library.
But that's where, right? I return where to the library? But that's not a direct object. It's an intransitive sentence. Intransitive means you can't transfer the action onto an object. I return to the library. But what happens if I say, I return, there aren't many books anymore being written, you know, but let's assume that 10 years from now there'll still be books being written, all right? I return the book to the library. Now, that same return that I have in English now is made transitive.
Right.
Because I have a direct object. What is a direct object? The book. All right. Now, by the way, I've got to tell you, I won't say where I asked it. It was in a yeshiva. I asked the boys, I said, how does... I can't tell you that yet. I have to first see, we have to hear Rashi. I know, now you're sitting with suspense. All right. Let's see what Rashi says. Rashi says, Hayalo lichto veheshiv et shivutcha. If indeed the sentence should read, he will return your captives. Oh, is that transitive or intransitive? He will return your captives.
Transitive,
sure, because the action is transferred onto captives. But he says, but if that's the case, we have an intransitive verb here, vishav. Vishav means it's as if I will return to the library, not return the book. In Hebrew, we do it. We use two different, same root, but two different forms. And Rashi says, I'm getting a mixed message here. On the one hand, it says vishav, I will return, let's say, to Israel, or he will return to Israel. And then it says he'll return something to Israel, because the word et always introduces a direct object. At least that's our presumption. So I got a mixed message. Is it an intransitive sentence? If that's the case, what is the word et doing here? And if it's a transitive sentence, then I would have thought it should be the heshiv. So it's like the picture a mathematic formula. So if it is unequal, all right. So I change one side or the other. Now, I asked the students, how does Rashi, and then and Rashi then solves it, and he says what, and then I'll get to the students. Rabotenu lamdu, he says, our teachers, our rabbis taught us, nikan from here, kevayachal shehashchina, from here we learn, from this very pasuk, that the shechina, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shora im Yisrael, dwells with Israel, betzarat galutam, in the pain of their exile. Ukshenigalin, and when they are redeemed, hichtiv geula l'atzmo, he then will dictate redemption for himself along with them. Shehu yashuv imahem, that he will dwell with them. He will return with them. As they will return, he, because he was with them, will return, just like he's in the room now. Okay? Beautiful, Rashi, is it not? And when you could picture Jews living in Minsk, and they're living in Pinsk, and they're living, and they've just gone through the Kishinev, and they've just gone through a pogrom, and they read this Rashi, and they said, it's hard to feel, but Hashem is with us, and when we'll be redeemed, he's going to go right back with us. So my question to the students was, how does Rashi know this? And I did not expect this answer. Almost in unison, they said, Ruach HaKodesh. So I said, I have two things to tell you. Number one, I can certainly imagine Rashi had Ruach HaKodesh. The second thing is, if Myers can figure it out, it ain't Ruach HaKodesh. That's the truth. That's not even false humility. All right, that's the truth. Because look, Rashi knew the rules of grammar, both in, he didn't know it in English, but the same rules apply. If I have an intransitive form, shove, and then I have the word et, it appears that I'm getting a mixed message. In the verb is intransitive, and et tells me there's a direct object. So one of the two sides has to change. Either I need to rethink my understanding of the word shove, or I have to rethink my understanding of the word et. So watch what Rashi does. he tells us that we need to rethink the word et. Et is like iti, itcha, itanu, with us, with. So Rashi then says, now it's not Rashi, it's the Medrash, right? The Medrash, hichtiv geula l'atzmo, that shehu yashuv imahem, he will return with them. So Rashi and the Medrash now re-understand the pasuk. Teshav Hashem alakecha, Hashem will return et shevutcha, with your captives. Now, they won't return your captives. He's here, he's with us, so he's going to return with the captives. And what the word tells us that? Et. Et, because we know, it can mean it's a preposition, as well as an introduction to a direct object, which, as you know, in English, we have no introductions to direct object. He builds a house, he returns the captives. There's no introduction to that, but in Hebrew, et gives me a hint. So what do we learn from this? That, in fact, we have to sometimes rethink our understanding of words. And once again here, what do we have? What is the nature of this? What is the nature of this problem, this koshi? It's syntax. Right, very good. The relationship of words to each other in a sentence. If I look at Vishav in a certain way, then I have to look at et in a certain way. And when they do not agree, or appear not to agree, then I have to rethink one or both. That's shot. Now my question to you is, let's see, I'm not going to do that. I can't ask you the question. I think we're going to want to the next example. But if you have any questions,
like what?
Lech lecha. Yeah, that's right for yourself. Right, but that would be an example of what? Syntax?
Syntax.
Yeah, we have a number of syntax. Hundreds. We just don't always realize it. Shall we move on to the next example? Number two. This one is not as complicated, because it deals with another element of pshat. In this case, we're going to look at semantics. Now, what I'm going to do, if I may, can I ask two people to pass this out? Thank you very much. Good, thank you so much. Let me just say this. Now, the very first example, I put Feshav, Heshiv, etc. there. Now we're on example two. Now, example two. Just one. Yeah, we just... Got it? We should have enough for everybody, I think. Oh, you give you all yours out? Okay, we probably have extra, I think. Oh, my. We're short? I had 30 that I ran. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh.
There's more in this row.
Oh, there's more in the row? Okay. There we go. Yeah. Okay, let's take another famous pasuk. Right? Yeah, our children have learned that as well. But remember, of course, the Torah. One of the most important things that I can say to myself and anybody who takes a course or a session with me is the Torah is set. The setting is Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. But it's talking about you and me. Because if it's not talking about you and me, then there's nothing for me to derive from it. So the one constant in all of human history is human nature. People respond and act to certain situations in a range of ways. All right. So the Torah is telling us about certain things. Now, Yaakov Avinu goes out to he runs away from his brother Esav, having gotten the bracha, which we can't analyze how he got the bracha or whether how ethical it was or not, but that's a koshin. Absolutely. I expect what appears to be perfect ethics. It appears that someone there is engaged in untruth, and if that's the case, I have a koshi. And to avoid that koshi, we can't do it here, but to avoid the koshi, of course, is not doing ourselves or the Torah any justice. But now he comes back from Laban's house. And he's, picture him on the east bank, roughly, of the Jordan River. And the Torah tells us that Yaakov gets up and he sees Malachi Elohim. He sees Machane Elohim. He sees angels, okay? And they confront him. And then the next parsha begins, Vayishlach. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim. Yaakov sent angels, Lefanam, let's call them angels, Malachim, El Esav Achiv, to Esav his brother, Arza Seir Sedei Adom, to where his brother was camped, dozens of miles away. Okay? Who'd like to tell me what Yaakov sent? And what is Malachim here? Huh?
Messengers.
How many say messengers? How many say angels? Nobody agrees with Rashi? Yes, they are. That's true. The Hebrew word la'och is a messenger, and it's they call it an Ugarit formulation. It's a Semitic language, but it does la'och, like malach, does mean to send. But the question is, are these extraterrestrial beings, or are they humans? All right. So here we have a machloket between Rashi and Uncalus. Now Uncalus preceded Rashi by 1,000 years. Uncalus preceded Rashi by 1,000 years. Now. Uncas says they were, as many of you feel, they were human beings. Yeah, he's coming home. He's afraid, of course. He doesn't know what awaits him. The last thing he knew, he ran away for his life 20 years before, and he sends messengers. But Rashi, interestingly, says Malachim Mamish. It's right underneath that where it says Rashi is Malachim Mamish. Actual super terrestrial beings, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they're also bringing a message.
Right.
So they fit into both camps.
They could, yes. Malachim could fit into both. That they were both. It is possible. It is possible. Although Rashi doesn't say that. All right. And nor does Uncalus. They both seem to say, as we would call it today, a zero sum game. They're either humans or they are, as mentioned, they are creations for a specific task. Now, but I don't want to rule it out. It's possible, right? Now, the question is, how many of you lean more towards Rashi? Anybody here? So then let me ask you a question. All right, since Rashi seems to be universally rejected in this room, with the exception of one. All right. Yeah. We certainly know that Rashi was a genius of monumental proportions. So my question to you is, why does he choose the non-obvious? And is it pshat that he's giving us, or is it drash? So, part of the answer, I believe, relies... Normally, if we were in class, we'd spend, you know, we'd really analyze this more deeply. But part of it relies on the fact that of what preceded this mission that Yaakov works. Vayivku vo malachei Elohim. In the pasuk before, the Torah tells us clearly... These are super-terrestrial, extraterrestrial beings. Why? Because they're called Malachei Elohim. Nobody disputes that. So maybe Rashi is saying those very same angels that he saw, and after all, why tell us about them if they don't have a function, are now used by Yaakov to send to Esav. Anybody like to make an argument the other way? Who'd like to defend Uncalus now? I hope I haven't switched you all that. Yes. Yeah.
My only defense for Uncalus would be something very, very simplistic. Mm-hmm. We are told that the closer to the tradition, the more correct you would be. And since Uncalus is hundreds of years closer, that would be my only simplistic.
Good. Right. So in other words, you're getting served by deductive reasoning, because if Uncalus says it, and he preceded Rashi by 1,000 years, he must be feel that's closer to Pshat. Possible, except Rashi's quoting a Medrash, which is a lot closer to Uncalus. Yeah.
If you don't have to go there, why go there?
Mm-hmm. Part of the argument is you only use that bullet if you have no other bullets, all right? But you have a perfectly acceptable opportunity. Let me mix the pot. Go ahead. One more question. I'm going to mix the pot, too. I'll take both of you.
Was referring to the Malachim that he met earlier, it should perhaps read Et HaMalachim, but it says Malachim in general.
Excellent. That certainly would be evidence to support Uncalus, right? Yeah. Good. Yes, good. That's very good. Yes?
Similarly, I was just going to say also that in the previous episode, it says Malachim specifically, but here it doesn't.
That's right. Both of those answers are, yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but both of those answers are fine. That's right. In other words, then why doesn't it say Malachi Elohim? Because the Torah is called the Malachi Elohim, or HaMalachim, because the Hey would indicate those very Malachim that he saw the night before. Very good. Okay, that's fine. Let me mix the pot a little bit. I did a little research. I have two ways to go with this. I could lie, all right, Oh, no, no, I wouldn't be lying. I could, shall we say, disguise the truth and say to you, I know that there are 212 references to Malach, Malachim, Malachim, whatever it is, right? 212. Now, of course, if I were dishonest, I would say, I just happen to know that. And of course, if I'm honest, I would tell you, I looked it up in a concordancia. Which, of course, deflates my, my ability to sound smart, but the smartness is sometimes in looking, knowing to look it up. So I did. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it ends there. So the thing is, 212 times, and the Concordancia, who is not a religious source, but a valid source, this is the Evan Shoshan, I looked up, said most of them are godly angels, not human messengers. Okay? So that would seem to tip the scale toward Rashi. Good. So which one is closer to Pshat? We don't know. But guess what? A, you and I are perfectly at liberty to say, I'm more inclined to Rashi, or I'm more inclined to Unkelis. But what's important to derive from this is that Pshat, more than one, in other words, two commentators can both be seeking Pshat. Pshat does not mean the correct answer. That's not Pshat. Right. Pshat means, does it fit to the context? Well, Rashi can demonstrate it fits the context. Yeah. Look to Psukim before. Unkelis certainly can say it because human beings send human beings. We'd have to find evidence that human beings send the divine creations. In order to say that Rashi is right or the Medrash. So that's how we can explore. Let's go to three. Our time is rapidly concluding. We have. What shall I choose? Okay, let's go to three. Let's go to three, knowing full well we may not get to four. Story of Yosef. Okay, poor Yosef. He's right. He's sent for some absolutely inexplicable reason by his father who loves him to go alone, unaided, into literally the human lion's den of his brothers whom his father knows despise him. And not only that, the trip isn't 3 miles. Think about it. They were near Hebron, and he's going to Shechem. We're talking about a long and rocky road, and even if the brothers loved him, it's a dangerous journey, okay? Now, what do? They see him, and they hatch a plot. We're going to throw him in the pit. And then, of course, Reuven says, "What good? Don't sell him. Just throw him in the pit. I mean, don't kill him." And then Yehuda says, "Listen," he says, "Ma betzaki naro get achina. There's no profit motive here. If we kill him, there's nothing here." Ah, but he sees the Yishmaelim coming, and sees the Midyanim, sees them coming, and he says, "Let's sell him." Okay, and they agree. Vayishmeu echav. Now, take a look at the second line on the top, kafchet, where it says vayavru. Okay, Vayavru Anashim Midyanim, Midyanite Socharim, our merchants came. Vayim Shechu, and they pulled. Vayalu, and they elevated. Et Yosef Minabor, Vayim Keru Et Yosef, and they sold Yosef. All I want to know from you is who sold Yosef? Ah, silence. Good. What? Yeah, the whole sentence. This is what we call at the very top the phenomenal, pronominal ambiguity. All pronouns are ambiguous. All pronouns, 3 minutes. Okay, all pronouns demand that you respond within 3 minutes to clarify the problem. All right, now, we won't be able to resolve this. Because if you say the brothers did it, and we have we can bring a number of sources where even Yosef says, "You sold me." But when we say you sold me, it doesn't necessarily mean you lifted me out of the pit. It means you were responsible for my plight. Okay? But if we wonder who actually sold him, they pulled him up, they elevated, they sold him. So you say, well, the brothers, they hatched the plot. Yeah, but then if that's the case, why are the Midyanim introduced here? If they're the ones, why are they introduced? And then you'll say, well, because he was sold to the Binyam. But it doesn't say that. It says he was sold to the Yishmaelim. The end of the Pasuk. Very difficult Pasuk. Right? But one thing is, it's not clear. that they bear responsibility is pretty clear. And by the way, you could ask, why would Hashem do that? Why would Hashem make a historical fact so indiscernible? The answer is not the. By the way, also be very careful. Never say the answer. There's never the answer. An answer, maybe. All right. So, you know, guilt and culpability is not always in the act itself. It's that which that the people who enable the act to take place have to bear great, maybe sole responsibility. So here the Torah deliberately doesn't say that his brothers did it. It says they. Whoever the they is, they were all complicit. And all of them must bear responsibility for it, perhaps in differing degrees, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu yodea machshavot. So he'll determine which degrees. Now, okay, now, but we're not done. I got to do one more quick thing here. Ooh, got 2 minutes. All right. Ready? Next pasuk. Next, same phrase, Vayishalachu, right under Bereishit. It's two psukim later. Vayishalachu et ketonet tapasim. They sent the ketonet tapasim, vayavi ol avihem, and they brought it to their father. Problem. Is there a problem here? All right, we talked about a pronominal ambiguity. That's a syntax problem. We got a big problem with this pasuk. You have two verbs that contradict each other. Did they send the coat or did they bring the coat? Did they send? See, if you have two verbs like or three verbs like in the pasuk before, okay, they don't contradict each other. It's all part of a process. Here, if they sent the coat, they didn't bring it, and if they brought the coat, they didn't send it. How do we resolve it? Two ways to resolve it, very quickly. One way in Chazal, they look. By the way, they both get the same signal. All right, but my wife and I are driving down the street. We both see the she's in one car, I'm in the other. Unlikely that we're going at the same speed, but we are, and we get to the exact same place, and then the green turns to yellow. All right away, we both have the same signal. To my wife, it is take the foot off the gas, put it on the brake. To me, it is move it. All right, so you have the same trigger. You have the same trigger. Two different responses. Now, one set of responses is very simply this: there were two groups. There were the senders among the brothers and the bringers. Why, we won't be able to get into, but it's there. But then, the remarkable statement. The Rashbam says, Sforno says, toward the bottom, he says, what did they do? Heviruha b'shelach. What does it mean, vayishalachu? It doesn't mean they sent. He said, the mistake you're making is that you think semantically. So we have a syntax problem, but he gives us a semantic solution. He says, you think it means to send. One of the Hebrew words for sword is shelach. Appears five times in Tanakh. Once again, my remarkable knowledge. All right, five times in Tanakh, the word shelach appears. And so he says, it doesn't mean they sent it. Shelach, they took the sword and they shattered and they tore it with a sword. And that's why I put in here, to catch a fish, one goes fishing. In other words, if you have a noun and you use that noun, so you can turn it into a verb. So, in other words, if I want to catch a fish, we call it fishing. If you want to shred something with a sword, you sword it, you shelach it. Vayishalachu, they use the shelach in order to tatter it, and then they sent it. That resolves the contract, and then they brought it. I'm sorry, then they brought it, not sent it. Then they brought it. So one way to solve it is to say different groups, the sellers, the bringers. The other way to solve it is, and the other way to solve it is say, look at the word shelach, vayishalachu. It would be the verb form of what you do with a shelach, what you do with a sword. And the Torah knows that, but of course we're 3,000 years distance from it, so we may have lost that. Sforno claims we may have. So which is closer to pshat? I don't know. But they both use basically the same rules, syntax, semantics, and context. Okay, we got to stop, so thank you very much, everyone.